My name is Maya Torres. I'm an investigative journalist. On the morning of June 6, 2025, ICE agents carried out sweeping immigration raids across Los Angeles. Over 100 individuals, mostly undocumented workers, were detained at workplaces including clothing factories in the Fashion District, a Home Depot, and multiple private residences. Within hours, protests erupted across the city. Some demonstrations remained peaceful. Others led to direct clashes with federal agents using tear gas, flashbangs, and rubber bullets. LAPD issued a citywide tactical alert. By day four, the Trump administration had deployed 4,000 National Guard troops and 700 U.S. Marines to LA, without the governor's consent. Governor Gavin Newsom and Mayor Karen Bass condemned the move as unconstitutional. Meanwhile, journalists, including myself, were caught in the middle. This is not just a story about immigration. It's a story about power, protest, federal overreach, and how truth is managed in a time of national conflict. Welcome to Shadowed Truths, inside the ICE raids that set Los Angeles on fire. What happened here affects all of us. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. The vanishing hour. It was Friday, June 6th. I woke up around 4:45 a.m. to a direct message from an immigration rights advocate I'd met once while covering a protest in Koreatown. The message was short, just six words. They're coming. Fashion District. 5:30. I was already halfway dressed before my coffee finished brewing. I grabbed my press badge, backup recorder, and left my phone behind. I use a burner when I'm on immigration stories. Too many people monitor metadata now. And what I was about to witness, I didn't want scrubbed. The sun was just bleeding over the skyline as I parked near San Julian Street. The Fashion District was quiet, mostly delivery trucks and garment workers unlocking warehouse gates. But just before 5:30, everything shifted. A white van without plates pulled up to the loading dock of a mid-sized apparel factory. Then another. Then two black Suburbans. ICE agents in dark tactical gear emerged quickly. Black vests, tan gloves, body cams blinking. No sirens. No announcements. Just movement. Workers were let out in pairs. Men, women, some still in aprons, many not speaking English. I counted at least two minors. A boy who looked about 16, and a girl barely older. Phones were confiscated. Employees were lined up against the back wall of the factory, zip-tied at the wrists, then separated by gender. I saw no warrant paperwork. No translators. Just flashlights and commands. Over the next 2 hours, I confirmed at least five locations had been hit simultaneously. Another textile plant, a Home Depot in Southgate, two private homes, and an auto body shop near El Sereno. A source within a local immigrant legal clinic confirmed. Over 100 detentions by noon. All ICE, no LAPD involvement. By 11:30 a.m., word had spread through WhatsApp groups and encrypted signal channels. Families flooded downtown. Activists rallied. Outside the federal detention center on Aliso Street, protesters began forming a line. Some had signs. Some just had names. I heard a woman yelling in Spanish, holding up a crumpled birth certificate. She was trying to prove her husband had TPS, temporary protected status. No one would speak to her. Around 2 p.m., the first confrontation occurred. A protester threw a water bottle at an ICE vehicle. Officers responded with pepper spray and what they called less lethal rounds, bean bags. I saw one man hit in the ribs. He collapsed. Medics rushed him across the street. I caught it on video. That evening, LAPD declared an unlawful assembly. Tactical alerts went citywide. That's when the uniforms changed. The National Guard arrived by 8 p.m. in Humvees. Over 2,000 troops were initially deployed to protect federal buildings. But by the next morning, it was 4,000, with 700 Marines added by presidential order. For the first time since the 1965 Watts Rebellion, the U.S. military was operating on California soil without state consent. Governor Gavin Newsom issued a public statement. This is a gross violation of constitutional boundaries and an insult to the people of California. Mayor Karen Bass echoed his outrage. We were not warned. We were not asked. We were simply invaded. As a journalist, I've covered ICE operations before. But this felt different. It felt engineered. Every detail, the timing, the coordination, the messaging, was calculated. It wasn't just about detaining immigrants. It was about control, a message. And behind the tactical teams, the DHS soundbites, and the army boots, I began to see something else taking shape. A test of obedience, a test of silence, and most dangerously, a test of how far fear can go in a democratic society before someone finally says, "Enough, my name is Maya Torres." And what I saw on June 6th was not just an immigration sweep. It was the beginning of something far more organized, far more manipulative. In the chapters ahead, I'll take you deeper. Inside the cells, behind the algorithm, beneath the camouflage, welcome to Shattered Truths. The facts are here. The question is, are we still listening? Screams behind glass. The elevator stopped at the fourth floor of the downtown federal building on Aliso Street. It was 7:46 a.m., June 7th. I was in. I'd signed in as a legal interpreter. Spanish speaking. Freelance. Not a lie, exactly. I do speak fluent Spanish. And in moments like these, truth and survival live side by side. The holding area smelled like bleach and burnt coffee. The windows were frosted. The security guards were silent. In a far corner, behind a plexiglass divider, I could see a woman pacing. I held up the interpreter badge. The officer nodded me through. The woman's name was Lourdes Pena, age 36. Seamstress. 2 children. No criminal record. She'd been picked up from her workplace in the fashion district less than 24 hours earlier. She hadn't spoken to her kids. No lawyer. She asked me one question over and over. ¿Esto es legal? Is this legal? I told her what I could. That she had rights. That legal aid was on the way. That nothing about this was normal. But inside, I wasn't sure. Not anymore. I interviewed 3 other detainees, 2 men and 1 elderly woman. All were arrested at workplaces. All lacked documentation, and none had criminal charges at the time of detention. What stood out wasn't just the fear. It was the precision. Each was identified using facial scans. I asked how. One of the men, Marco, a mechanic from Southgate, whispered the name of a company I didn't recognize. They used a prediction score, something about a risk rating. They said the camera knew I was lying. It didn't make sense. Until later that day, when I met with a source from a local nonprofit immigration law firm. She handed me a redacted document, a federal contract between ICE and a private surveillance analytics firm called Cerebrum Dynamics. The document confirmed something staggering. ICE was deploying biometric behavioral scanning software during raids. The system used facial recognition, micro-expression analysis, and nonverbal deception detection algorithms. In other words, they weren't just checking IDs. They were using predictive behavioral analytics, tools originally developed for military operations in Afghanistan. The technology wasn't new. What was new was how it was being used. Civilian workplaces. U.S. soil. Detaining people not based on evidence, but on scanned emotional reactions. Let that sink in. A system scanning your face to determine whether you're truthful. That system triggering an arrest. And that arrest becoming the basis for deportation. I contacted ICE's media office. Their statement read, "All procedures follow Department of Homeland Security guidelines. Biometric scanning is used to enhance officer safety and improve identification." No mention of predictive scoring. No mention of Cerebrum Dynamics. The next day, the protests intensified. Outside the detention facility where Lourdes was still being held, I stood behind a row of chain-link fencing. A group of protesters chanted names. Names of fathers, mothers, daughters. "Say their names. Bring them home." A loudspeaker crackled above us. "This is a federal facility. You are trespassing." Then came the sounds I will never forget. Screams from behind the glass. Somewhere inside, detainees were yelling. I couldn't make out the words. But I could hear pounding. Fists hitting walls, metal trays thrown. Whether it was protest, panic, or pain, we never found out. Officers blocked all camera views. Later that evening, ICE released a statement. There were no disturbances reported at any facility. But I was there. And I heard them. That night, I began digging into Cerebrum Dynamics. I traced their contracts back to a 2018 Pentagon-funded initiative for AI-powered threat profiling. Their technology had never passed peer review in any open academic forum. It wasn't FDA-regulated. It wasn't governed by DOJ oversight. it was unregulated psychological scoring software, quietly licensed for use by federal immigration agents. What's happening here isn't just about ICE. It's about a new form of enforcement, one that combines predictive surveillance, algorithmic bias, and government secrecy. It's about manipulating the definition of guilt and automating the consequences. And the worst part, most Americans still don't know it's happening. In the next chapter, I'll take you into the hidden server room where the algorithm runs. I'll show you the firm's marketing deck, where immigration isn't even mentioned. What is mentioned are three words that chilled me: behavioral compliance modeling. My name is Maya Torres, and I'm only beginning to understand the machinery behind these raids. Stay with me. Algorithm of fear. In every story, there's a moment when the question shifts from what happened to why. For me, that moment came on June 8th, 2 days after the ICE raids. I was reviewing raw notes and detention logs when I found the same phrase in three different intake summaries. Subject flagged by BDSS score. BDSS. I'd seen the acronym buried in redacted DHS contracts before. Behavioral Decision Support System. That's what led me to Cerebrum Dynamics, the predictive analytics firm mentioned last chapter. According to a 2023 Department of Homeland Security procurement log, Cerebrum was awarded a $47 million contract to enhance compliance pre-screening methods using AI-driven evaluation models. No peer-reviewed studies, no civilian oversight. And now, that same system was scanning factory workers' facial expressions in Los Angeles. I reached out to a contact I'd made during earlier reporting on law enforcement surveillance. He agreed to meet. The location, a warehouse on the edge of Vernon, a nondescript industrial park. No signage. Inside, servers. Rows and rows of blinking towers stacked in columns. Private security at the door. He walked me through it. The BDSS system doesn't operate like traditional law enforcement databases. It doesn't match fingerprints or check warrants. Instead, it uses live feed video, often from mobile ICE units, to scan micro expressions. Eye twitching, brow movement, nasal dilation, vocal hesitation. Then it applies a compliance score. A number above 0.7, the subject is deemed non-cooperative, flagged for high-risk behavior. And that number is what ICE used to justify detention. The official term for this is predictive behavioral modeling. But make no mistake, this is profiling. Not by race, not by religion, by algorithm. My contact, a former contractor, showed me the system's back-end dashboards. Real-time population heat maps, color-coded confidence metrics, internal ICE manuals labeled, emotional signal calibration techniques. One document compared behavior patterns of detainees from El Salvador, Honduras, and Mexico. I asked, was this software designed for immigration enforcement? He shook his head. Originally, it was meant for battlefield interrogation support in Bagram. That's Afghanistan. The system was repurposed, adapted for domestic law enforcement without undergoing any public ethical review. The next day, I brought this information to an immigration attorney in Koreatown. Her response: they're detaining people based on facial math. How do you appeal a machine? What we're witnessing here is the privatization of perception, where human behavior, fear, confusion, even grief, is treated as data, where compliance is quantified, where deportation begins with a decimal point. Cerebrum Dynamics, meanwhile, boasts on its public website that its platform provides emotional pre-screening capabilities for real-time population mitigation. Those are the company's own words. Population mitigation. Their public clients include ICE. Their private ones? Undisclosed. This technology has implications far beyond Los Angeles. If it spreads to border crossings, airports, DMV offices, where does it end? And what happens when the algorithm gets it wrong? At what point does fear become policy? My name is Maya Torres. In the next chapter, we shift focus. A college student disappears during a protest. Arrest records say he was never booked. GPS data says otherwise. Join me in chapter 4, the protester who vanished. Because some stories don't end with numbers. They end with silence. The protester who vanished. His name was Javier Cruz, 21 years old, political science major at Cal State LA, first-generation college student, dreamer. On June 7th, Javier was seen marching with a student protest group near MacArthur Park, one of several flashpoint locations in the aftermath of the ICE raids. his boyfriend, Daniel, last saw him around 6:40 p.m. Javier had broken away from the group to help an older woman who had fallen during a pushback between demonstrators and federal agents. Minutes later, a black van pulled up behind the barricade line. Witnesses say three men in unmarked uniforms stepped out. They grabbed Javier, zip-tied him, and shoved him into the van. No badge numbers. No names. No statements. That was the last time anyone saw him. When Daniel filed a missing persons report, LAPD said they had no record of an arrest. ICE denied involvement. No video was available from the nearest traffic cams, damaged during protest activity. But 3 days later, Daniel received a strange message. It came through Signal, an encrypted app both he and Javier used. The text was scrambled, fragmented. One phrase was clear. Black site Vic. You were right. Vic, short for Victorville, a desert city 80 miles northeast of Los Angeles, home to a large federal correctional complex and several off-book government storage facilities. I drove there 2 days later. No official facilities listed Javier Cruz in their detainee roster. But at a gas station outside town, I met someone who changed everything. His name was withheld for his safety. Former contract worker for a logistics vendor that serviced temporary DHS detention units. His words, they're not always booked. Some of these kids, they're held off manifest. It's how they trial new compliance setups without triggering oversight. Off manifest, not formally arrested, not charged, just removed. I requested FOIA records for all ICE-related detentions between June 6th and June 10th. Javier Cruz's name never appeared. No aliases. No clerical errors. He didn't exist administratively. Then came a voicemail, left anonymously on my encrypted work line. The voice was digitally altered, but the message was clear. Cruz was flagged BDSS 0.89. Non-compliant. Emotional threshold exceeded. BDSS, the behavioral decision support system we explored in Chapter 3. The compliance scoring algorithm. 0.89, above the risk threshold. Javier had been flagged during a protest by an algorithm. The voicemail ended with this. Test site. Victorville perimeter. Night holds only. That's when I started making calls. Former DHS attorneys. Civil liberties groups. Military contractors. I asked the same question. Is there legal precedent for detaining U.S. residents without formal arrest using algorithmic risk scoring? The answers came in two forms. One group said no. Such detentions were unconstitutional, indefensible, and ripe for challenge. The other group said nothing at all. Silence, I've learned, is often the loudest confirmation. On June 12th, I filed a legal motion with the help of the ACLU requesting full public disclosure of all temporary ICE contract holding sites in the Victorville region. As of this recording, that motion remains unanswered, and Javier Cruz remains missing. This isn't just a story about ICE or one young man. It's a story about the quiet expansion of federal power, about systems that operate beyond visibility, and about a new kind of social control, one based not on evidence, but on emotional probability. We are watching the erosion of legal norms in real time, and it's happening to people like Javier, who vanish, not because they were guilty, but because they were scored as dangerous by a machine. In the next chapter, I'll return to Los Angeles, to a protest on Broadway that escalated into a night of violence, tear gas, and an unexpected leak. A flash drive labeled Tools and Tactics, reclaiming the narrative. What's on that drive changed everything. Join me in Chapter 5, Smoke Over Broadway. Smoke Over Broadway. Saturday, June 8th. Protesters filled Broadway between Temple and First Street. Thousands of them, packed shoulder to shoulder. I stood on the edge of the crowd near the south steps of City Hall. Press badge visible. Recorder rolling. The sign said it all. No ICE in our streets. Whose city? Our city. Stop algorithmic deportation. Around 6:12 p.m., the first smoke grenade was deployed. It wasn't LAPD. It was the National Guard. Troops in full gear formed a wall in front of the federal building, rifles slung, visors down. Protesters surged, chanting louder. Some threw plastic bottles. One man shouted, "They're not even from here." Then came the flashbangs. Loud, disorienting. One exploded near a group of high school students holding a banner. I watched as one girl stumbled and fell, face bloodied. A medic rushed to her side. I followed them to a safe zone behind the courthouse. There, beneath an emergency tent, I interviewed three protest medics. One of them, Josiah, told me, "These aren't crowd control tactics. They're battlefield tactics. These guys are trained for insurgency, not public dissent." He showed me a spent gas canister. The label read, "CTOPS Delivery 3.0, Property of Palmyra Dynamics." Palmyra Dynamics is a Virginia-based military contractor, known for developing riot suppression tech used during U.S. military interventions abroad. And now their equipment was on our streets. That's when someone tapped me on the shoulder. A protester in a black hoodie. No name. No introduction. Just a flash drive pressed into my hand. "This is what they're using. Your press. Get it out." I left the protest that night and headed to a secure Wi-Fi location downtown. Opened the drive. A folder titled, "Tools and Tactics, Reclaiming the Narrative, Version 5.7. Inside were documents, slide decks, video walkthroughs. The files were labeled with DHS metadata. Some bore the logo of Cerebrum Dynamics, the same firm behind the BDSS behavioral scoring system. The contents? A media manipulation toolkit, pages on de-escalation messaging, asset framing, and visual threat reclassification. One chart outlined protest response strategies by media framing. Peaceful protest equals community passion. Clashes equals security threat justification. Youth organizing equals activism risk amplifier. Another document instructed personnel to leverage user-generated content to support lawful response optics. In other words, turn live streams and social media posts into propaganda tools. I forwarded the materials to a digital forensics analyst at Stanford. She confirmed the flash drive's metadata matched DHS encryption signatures. It was real. I now had proof that the same system scoring immigrants for detention was also manipulating public perception. I reached out to the DHS press office. No comment. Palmyra Dynamics did not respond to emailed requests. The next morning, social media lit up with conflicting stories. Conservative outlets reported violent anarchist mobs endangering public safety. A few mainstream networks ran heavily edited protest footage, clipped just before the flashbangs hit. The girl who bled on the sidewalk? She never made the news. This is what I mean when I say, reclaiming the narrative. It's not just about boots and batons. It's about controlling the lens, engineering stories, silencing context. In the digital age, perception is policy. In the next chapter, that truth will come full circle. Because when I tried to publish what I found, my article never saw daylight. My editor ghosted me, and I discovered my newsroom had just been acquired by a firm with direct ties to Palmyra Dynamics. I'll tell you what happened when I went rogue, when I stopped being press and became the target. Join me in Chapter 6, The Journalist's Dilemma. Because when journalism becomes dangerous, the story becomes personal. The Journalist's Dilemma. I filed my story at 3:14 a.m. on June 9th. A 2,600-word expose. Subject line: Government Contracts, Behavioral Scoring, and Suppression of Protest Narratives. I had sources, documents, audio evidence, a legally cleared Stanford forensic report verifying the flash drive's metadata. I submitted it to my editor, someone I've worked with for over a decade. Usually, he replies within 90 minutes. But by noon, I had nothing. At 1:41 p.m., I got a single-line message, holding this one for legal review. I knew what that meant. I've seen this before. I called. No answer. Texted. No reply. I checked our internal CMS to find my story had been locked under a restricted status. Not flagged for edits, just hidden. That's when I did something I hadn't done in years. I opened our corporate ownership chart. And there it was. 10 days before the raids, our parent company, a hedge fund media conglomerate, had finalized a quiet acquisition of three West Coast outlets. One of those outlets was ours. And the hedge fund's private holdings included a strategic communications firm that, you guessed it, had secured federal contracts with Palmyra Dynamics. The same Palmyra Dynamics whose equipment I saw on Broadway. The same Palmyra Dynamics whose talking points were embedded in the Reclaiming the Narrative flash drive. My outlet hadn't just blocked the story. It had been structurally absorbed by the very forces the story exposed. That's when I made the choice. A line I never wanted to cross. I went rogue. I used a clean VPN and uploaded the documents, anonymously, to a decentralized publishing network used by whistleblowers and academic researchers. Then I launched a new podcast stream using my backup credentials. I called it Shadows of Justice. First upload, ICE, emotion surveillance, and the algorithm you've never heard of. Within 24 hours, it had 3,000 downloads. By day 3, 18,000. By day 5, I was trending, but the price came quickly. My newsroom credentials were revoked. My bio was pulled from the official staff page. I received a letter from the outlet's legal department citing unauthorized release of proprietary reporting. They tried to bury me using copyright law. What they didn't expect was what came next. On June 11th, I received an email from an anonymous address with the subject line, "You're not the only one." The body of the message included 6 names, all journalists, all women, all had attempted to report on the same raid events or connected surveillance systems. All had been silenced, and all of them had one thing in common. They'd all been quietly labeled as emerging risk communicators in an internal Palmyra Dynamics presentation deck leaked earlier that year. I was one of them. It made sense. The narrative control wasn't just about protesters or immigrants. It was about information gatekeepers, people like me. This wasn't a media blackout. It was a strategic communications suppression plan. The scary part? It wasn't illegal, because none of this was happening through government censorship. It was all happening through private infrastructure, through mergers, contracts, lobbyists who'd gamified ethics. In the next chapter, I leave the city. I travel to a secluded cabin near Big Bear to meet someone who worked inside DHS policy circles during the algorithm's early development. He gave me something more dangerous than a flash drive. He gave me a theory. The ICE raids were just a live pilot. The real target isn't immigration. It's mass public compliance. Chapter 7 is called Celestial Insights and Political Shadows. And what's coming next may shake everything we think we know about democracy in 2025. Celestial Insights and Political Shadows. I left Los Angeles at 3:02 a.m. No traffic, no news alerts. Just darkness and one set of coordinates sent by an anonymous contact 2 days earlier. Big Bear Region, Cabin 44. Speak only in person. I followed the winding backroads past shuttered ski lodges and forgotten airbnbs. No cell service. When I arrived, a man in his early 60s opened the door. He didn't introduce himself, didn't have to. I'd seen him testify before Congress during the early DHS hearings on facial recognition in airports. A former senior systems architect for Homeland Security, now fully off-grid. He asked that I refer to him only as Daniel. We spoke for 5 hours. I recorded none of it. What he told me reframed everything I thought I knew. According to Daniel, the ICE raids were not the end goal. They were a stress test, part of a long-standing DHS internal framework labeled Celestial Insight, a program designed to monitor public sentiment and behavioral response to federal force in multicultural urban environments. The idea was born out of the 2020 protests, accelerated under emergency pandemic powers, quietly repackaged through private sector conduits. They realized you don't need martial law to study resistance. You just need chaos and cameras. Under Celestial Insight, behavioral data from ICE raids was cross-referenced with social media trends, local news cycles, and biometric feedback from protesters. That data was then funneled into machine learning models, used to refine compliance prediction scores and public tolerance thresholds. In short, they weren't just arresting immigrants. They were studying how society reacts to fear. I asked Daniel where the funding came from. He showed me redacted budget sheets from a Senate Select Committee on Advanced Conflict Preparedness. The budget line was buried under civil contingency technologies. I scanned it. One familiar name appeared. Palmyra Dynamics. Another entry caught my eye. Narrative Risk Calibration, Integrated Pilot Initiative. Status active. I asked what that meant. He replied, "It means they're not just watching the riots, they're predicting the next ones." Then he showed me the presentation slides. PowerPoint decks labeled, "Urban Emotional Fracture Mapping, Public Trust Collapse Scenarios, Narrative Engineering Metrics, Q2. Each slide featured charts measuring emotional language usage on Twitter, body heat fluctuation in drone footage, even rage clustering based on facial tension from crowd surveillance. It was chilling. Surveillance no longer measured movement. It measured feeling. I asked him point blank, "Who is this really for?" He said, "Not ICE. Not even DHS. This is for the next administration. They're preloading control systems so the next president can walk into a ready-made behavioral architecture, one that can suppress dissent without declaring war on civil rights. I left the cabin just before dawn, my recorder still off, my hands shaking. Back in Los Angeles, I replayed every conversation from the past week in my head. The raids, the scoring algorithms, the girl bleeding on Broadway, the protester who vanished. And I realized, this wasn't a chapter in American history. It was a prototype. In the final chapter, we returned to downtown. I tracked down one last lead, a whistleblower embedded in the narrative response team at Palmyra Dynamics. What she tells me confirms everything. But what happens next, I never saw coming. The final chapter is called Operation PS1. And in it, everything gets exposed or buried. Join me for the conclusion. Operation PS1. I returned to downtown Los Angeles on June 12th. The city felt quieter now, not safer, just subdued. The raids had stopped. The protests thinned. Most media coverage had shifted to other topics. The presidential campaign, a celebrity trial, the latest AI rollout from Silicon Valley. But the system behind the silence was still in place. And I wasn't done. At 4:22 p.m., I arrived on the rooftop of the old LA Times building, the place where I first trained as a reporter. I was there to meet my final source. She worked inside Palmyra Dynamics, specifically in their narrative response division. Her job, to engineer stories before they're told. She didn't give a name. She wore a plain black hoodie. She carried a single flash drive. It was labeled Operation PS1. She didn't say much. Just this. PS1 isn't a file name. It's an abbreviation. It stands for Population Suppression Phase 1. The drive contained two folders. One was internal documentation of the ICE raid narrative calibration framework. The other was a map, a color-coded overlay of the entire United States. Cities marked with green, yellow, orange, and red zones. Los Angeles red, Chicago yellow, Miami orange. The zones corresponded to compliance thresholds. Each region was assigned a narrative package. Protest fatigue saturation, localized crisis redirection, ethical chaos justification. These weren't just talking points. These were entire editorial cycles designed and distributed to co-opt local newsrooms and social media trends in real time. The goal wasn't to hide events. It was to flood the information space with so many disjointed, emotionally loaded micronarratives that coherence collapsed. What was left behind wasn't truth. It was confusion. And in confusion comes control. I asked the whistleblower, "What happens in phase two?" She paused, then said, "Nothing. That's the point. If you can make a country forget what it was angry about last week, you don't need force. You just need momentum. Population suppression. Phase one complete." As I walked away from the meeting, I realized what I needed to do. I wasn't going to pitch this to a newsroom. I wasn't going to hand it to a senator. I was going to broadcast it, in full, on this very channel. This is my final transmission. I've uploaded all documents, redacted only where absolutely necessary to protect sources. If you're listening, I need you to do more than just consume. I need you to remember, because suppression doesn't start with tanks. It starts with distraction, with silence, with narrative decay. And if we lose our grip on what's real, even for a moment, they don't need to censor us. We'll censor ourselves. My name is Maya Torres, and this was Shadowed Truths.